The great thing about bureaucracies is how they ignore the bleeding obvious. Let me give you an example, and I quote, "Stepping down the ladder on July the 20th, 1969, to become the second man on the moon, Buzz Aldrin had to remember not to shut his spaceship's door. NASA, you see, had omitted to put a handle on the outside, and if shut, neither he nor Armstrong could get back in. They would have died." Brian Appleyard in the Sunday Times of London. Well, handles also appear to be missing on many of the schemes to bring transport systems up to 21st century standards. Here's Marcus Clayton, who runs a firm in Melbourne.
John Bennett, my business partner, fixes engines. He's been fixing engines for 50 years. First he works out what's wrong with them, thinks about the problem and what is deficient, proposes solutions, tests the results, measures them with great accuracy against his benchmarks, and when satisfied, pronounces it an honest effort. The engines he fixed in the 60s and 70s were for road vehicles and for motorsport. He fixed them so well that soon they had claimed Australian touring car championships, speedway and drag racing titles, and was instrumental in fixing the Falcon GT to produce the Bathurst-winning Ford GTHO Phase 3. These cars were fixed so well, they now change hands for upwards of $500,000. He then took up a new challenge with motorcycle racing. Australian titles followed, and the bikes and sidecars he produced were totally dominant in Australia. A lot was learned in those years, especially when running methanol-based fuels in the motorbikes, and by careful design and calibration, these machines were able to demonstrate a quiet and stable idle, great progression and extreme power. Andrew Johnson, who rode some of these weapons, described them as having a torque tap rather than a throttle because the response was so linear and easy to control. Sometime after this, in early 1985, he ordered two Toyota Land Cruisers to use as work vehicles. When delivered, one turned out to be diesel-powered, and the diesel to be so noisy he could not even hear the radio, and barely capable of 100 kilometres an hour. He took the vehicle to the workshop, removed and modified the head and pistons, put in some spark plugs and an LPG system, and returned to the dealer 2 days later and told him he'd fixed the noise. The car would then tow a heavy trailer at the speed limit and was vastly improved on hills. His career so far had created some classic demonstrations and potentially a pathway to practical and sustainable future engines. And JB was soon invited to Brazil, where the government had decided to start turning the huge sugar glut into ethanol fuel to power the transport fleet in that country. The engine development engineers encountered the usual problems. They found it extremely difficult to make an engine run without sputter, misfire, and high fuel consumption, and the motors were clearly unacceptable for general use. JB was allocated an engine laboratory and staff, and within 3 weeks of arrival had fixed a demonstration engine which ran extremely well, and the principle of his design was used in subsequent ethanol engines in Brazil. JB spent the next year testing, refining and lecturing both in Brazil and at CRMT in France. The outcome was that by the end of the 1980s, 72% of light vehicles and well over 90% of private cars in Brazil were operating on ethanol. JB returned to Melbourne in 1987, where he set up his own laboratory, specifically for heavy-duty engines, fitting it out with the best instrumentation that could be had and building his own when commercially available equipment was not good enough. He was commissioned by the Defence Department to audit their big diesel engines and completed a 2-year program. He was also asked to manage Australia's biggest engine reconditioning operation, and in a few months had reduced warranty claims from 30% to less than 3%. All this experience had alerted JB to the fact that there was a lot that needed fixing on nearly all engines he had seen, and set him on a course to focus on exactly that. Diesel exhaust is so filthy that it is a health hazard to measure operating parameters even in transient conditions, never mind the hours of running at full load required to duty rate an engine and pronounce it fit for the task. Remembering the old Land Cruiser lesson, it was decided to experiment with converting an Isuzu truck engine to spark ignition and running it on LPG. This was immediately successful in making the dyno room habitable, but the motor did not match a diesel in some areas of specific fuel consumption. JB worked on this problem systematically, benchmarking and testing, and as he expected, the torque and power rose as the specific fuel consumption dropped until the motor comfortably exceeded the benchmark diesel in every respect. In 1997, a breakthrough. A Melbourne bus company fleet manager contacted JB for help. they were in serious trouble and had lost control of the fleet maintenance costs. This is about the time I met JB and started to get involved. After spending some time working out what problems there were and devising a way to tackle them, JB presented his findings. The company then gave him the bus from hell, which had been quarantined from further service, as so much had been spent fixing it, including two engine rebuilds. The bus was audited and measured according to the procedure and template now well established. About this time, a patent was applied for which enabled easy conversion of diesel to spark ignition. The engine ran on LPG, and the support systems and installation engineering were investigated and, where practical, optimised. The results were stunning. The bus ran every day without passengers for 6 months and then was in service for 2 years on regular routes. The fuel saving was over 25%. Oil consumption reduced from 2 litres a day to half a litre per year, and the maintenance costs were reduced to almost nothing. The noise levels reduced by 50% and vibration was undetectable. It was now the bus that every driver wanted to use. The journalist Bill Tuckey, reporting in the Business Review Weekly in July 1998, saw the now legendary demonstration of this engine operating at full load, with a 50-cent piece balanced on the cylinder head. The bus was tested several times for emissions and fuel consumption. It used slightly more fuel in litres than a diesel, but was far more fuel efficient, as LPG is much less dense and cheaper to buy than diesel fuel. Compared to the diesel, CO2 was down to 90%, hydrocarbon 5%, NOx 1%, CO 4%, and black smoke, PM10 particles, less than 0.1 of 1%. Great jubilation followed, politicians made announcements, and $80 million was made available through the Alternative Fuels Conversion Program, administered through the Greenhouse Office. So where are all the LPG and methanol motors? Unfortunately, despite the undoubted support of the community and the rhetoric of government and institutions, there are massive hurdles to be overcome by small and innovative companies. These usually take the form of seemingly innocuous regulations, which may be well-meaning, but usually have a consequence which takes an enormous effort to overcome. Most bureaucrats and politicians I have met are supportive of our aims, but very few will have the ability, power, or inclination to take any action. Some examples. The fuel rebate. An irrigation pump using diesel fuel routinely faces a $20,000 a month fuel bill, with a rebate of about $6,000. If the farmer chooses to utilise LPG, he is then disqualified from any government assistance through this avenue. LPG has become viable only through the incremental increase in diesel costs. So the clean-burning local fuel attracts no subsidy from the government and is therefore threatened by diesel suppliers being able to offer attractive but short-lived price deals to farm users. The registration. Another company in Melbourne has demonstrated LPG heavy trucks using the JB patent. They properly engineered the vehicle and had it certified and emissions tested. Running without catalysts, it exhibited emissions significantly less than the Euro 4 compliant diesels. When it came time to fully register the truck, the registration was refused, as the original Euro 3 compliance had been tampered with. The South Australian testing did not count, as it was not performed on the specified test dyno. The correct type of dyno does not exist in Australia, so the only option available is to send the vehicle to Europe for certification. This situation arose because the Australian standard for emissions is a word-for-word copy of the Euro standard. We do not manufacture trucks here, so there is no need for certified equipment. The you do not need to know. An announcement was made on the 20th of February 2009 of a $435 million renewable energy demonstration. Registration closed on the 4th of March 2009, just 12 days later. A government source became aware of it through a public service newsletter, which is circulated on a restricted basis. The newsletter arrived 11 days after the closing date for submissions. This is an example of maintaining the status quo, as anybody out of the mainstream will have no chance to demonstrate new technologies. Furthermore, it would be unusual for a company to demonstrate a technology that would threaten their market share or profitability, and in fact, they would have an incentive to ensure that a technology fails. Remember the $80 million grant for the Alternative Fuels Conversion Program administered by the Greenhouse Office? Well, they came to see us to give us some money. We explained to them the difference between a diesel and a spark engine, and we had a pleasant chat. A few weeks later, they made that offer conditional on a building an engine to their specification, which include exhaust catalysts, filters, and a particular type of engine management computer. Clearly, they had become engine experts very quickly. They ultimately spent some money on an experimental program in WA, using new engines from a US manufacturer. 40 engines were built with catalysts, filters, and a specified computer, and 40 engines failed in short order. No existing engines were ever converted. We view LPG as an important transitional fuel, which is widely available. LPG-optimised engines differ slightly from methanol-fueled ones, both having extremely low emissions, but the enabling technology is the same. If, as a thought experiment, we decided to run our diesel infrastructure on methanol by 2019, what would be the result? About 300,000 engines would have to be remanufactured each year, fully employing the ailing automotive parts industry. We are reusing existing engines where suitable, capturing the value added in manufacture. We are replacing many billion dollars of imported fuel with a local product. Pressure on the health budget would ease as the health cost associated with diesel emissions disappears. The EPA estimates this to be $9,000 per vehicle per year for Euro 4 compliant vehicles and almost $30,000 for Euro 1 vehicles. This does not include the PM2.5 particles that are currently unregulated, but are estimated to double the costs. It also assumes the exhaust catalysts and filters are in working order. Transport oil spills would no longer be serious. Methanol is water-soluble and degrades very quickly under microbial attack. Barney Farran and Chris Marden produced one of the many models of a methanol economy as part of a CSIRO resource futures program and concluded the following. About 30 million hectares, or 4% of Australia's landmass, of non-productive agricultural land can be sustainably planted with suitable wood crops. This would nearly double the size of the agricultural sector. About 150 regional methanol refineries would be built, bringing much needed employment to regional areas. Urban sewage would be collected and refined to methanol. And the CO2 from this fuel would become negative, as the solid carbon char is a byproduct of methanol refining. As we move through peak oil, the change to renewable fuels is inevitable, as oil becomes more expensive and more energy is required to refine and deliver it to the market. The technology to make an early transition exists now. Our engines are working as we speak. The difficulty is not the technology, but the artificial barriers erected around existing mainstream products and the policies that on one hand claim to want a greener outcome, but on the other actually protect and encourage the status quo. The bureaucracy will always say, "We will not pick winners," and "let the market decide." This is fine if the market is fair, but the market is far from fair. Subsidies to multinational companies and to the users of their products ensure that anything that is not mainstream seems expensive. When I pointed out the government's own figures for the health cost of diesel vehicles in an urban area was over $300 million a year, a senior official commented, "I know, but you'll not get anywhere with that argument because we meet national air quality standards." If these attitudes are not reversed and sustainability is not encouraged to flourish, then we are facing a very bleak future as we run out of resources at an exponential rate. The country has to pick winners and nurture them. It's now obvious that new farm-grown fuel industries must be of the highest priority to ensure our prosperity into the future.
And an interesting future it promises to be. Marcus Clayton is CEO of the firm Bennett Clayton in Melbourne. Next week, Professor Chris Nordin on osteoporosis and vitamin D and a story of massive neglect in treatment. I'm Robin Williams.